Do you mind if I have a strange request? It's this. I really want to send my
money. Of course. I'll do it at once. What was it you asked for?
Never mind, I'll smoke one of my own.
Goonpod. I am joined this week by returning guest, Tim Worthington. Regular listeners will know that Tim has been on twice before, first time around to talk about the Peter and Sophia LP, and then he came back again to talk about the tremendous film, the 1966 romp, The Wrong Box. This week, Tim is here to talk about an actual Goon Show episode, one that he enjoys very much, the classic Tales of Old Dartmoor. And when Tim first joined me, we spent quite a bit of time gossiping and catching up and whatnot. And we could have easily talked about stuff and nonsense all evening. But then I said, Tim, why did you choose Tales of Old Dartmoor?
Well, this is the episode of The Goon Show that means the most to me, really, because it was literally, genuinely the first I ever heard of them. Because my father had, and I've got it in front of me now, the album, The Best of the Goon Shows, yes. Which somehow survived. There was a box of records when I was growing up that had belonged to my parents, which there was that weird thing in those days that you were supposed to give up things like an interest in music when you started a family. I always think of, in Soul Survivors, that book about Northern Soul and the Wigan Casino, one of the sort of original Northern Soul fans, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, but a guy from Scotland talks about how he kind of discovered, at the same time as a lot of people across the country, weirdly, this subgenre of soul music, because when he was on holiday, he met a welder who said to him, I'm getting married, so I have to give away my records. Can I give them to you? So there was a box of records, and some had survived, some hadn't. There's a lot of comedy stuff like that. Who was it that did something called The First Family, which, you know, very narrow window to do this. It was send-ups of John F. Kennedy and his family with like a full cast recording. I think there were two albums of it. Both of those had survived. There were a couple of Hancock albums, things like there were some, some Pat Boone records. I assume it was my mother liked. There were quite a few instrumental hit singles like Jet Harris and Tony Meehan and, you know, the Tornadoes, people like that.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff had clearly disappeared over the years. There were defaced Beatle album covers.
Oh, no.
The like. And Goon-wise, there was a broken 78 of I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas. There was Max Geldre's Goon with the Wind with no record in it.
Oh.
And it took me years and years to find that. But this, which I played because I think, you know, I knew who Spike Milligan was because I'd seen him on Jack and Ori and things like that. I was vaguely aware of Peter Sellers. Certainly knew. I don't know how I knew who Harry Secombe was because this would have been pre-Highway. But I sort of knew who they were and thought the cover looked funny and listened to it. And I really, really loved it. And I love it because on this record, It was different with comedy albums in those days. Either people re-recorded existing radio or television scripts in the studio, usually with George Martin producing, or they were edited down like this with an album in mind, with a listening experience in mind. And it's not, it was never quite the same when you got those full show releases of things later. This is almost an artifact in its own right. And it just absolutely zips along in this form. And I loved it. And some of the jokes in it made me almost cry laughing when I was, what, 5, 6 or something, still make me laugh now in this.
Yeah. You mentioned George Martin. He actually was involved in the selection of the two episodes on this LP.
Yes, but this is my one major problem with it. Apart from the fact that, well, there's an advert on it, which I'll come back to in a minute, but the sleeve notes are not even written by George Martin, never mind one of the goons. It's Doug Geddes, who was the sort of head of PR and marketing at Parlophone at the time, who he just goes into a quite boring bigging up of the goons, which is not very impressive. He talks about, he defines goonatics as those who listen to the show in an upstairs room, which even, you try and imagine that in Spike's delivery, and even then it wouldn't quite land as a joke. There was, even the Resistance took time off to listen and then she married me. Oh, come on, try a bit harder. I did notice at the bottom of the record, there's an advert for Emitex, which is all over EMI records in the 50s and early 60s, and it's a record cleaner thing. And it just stands out to me because it's just there as an advert. You've got these sleeve notes, not by any of the goons. You compare it to, you know, it's part of my rejection of the idea that Python just copied the goons. And obviously, they took a lot of cues from them. But when you look at the Python records, it's what Joel Morris, the comedy writer, describes this as total comedy, where they've messed with everything, even the copyright date, even the barcode.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, how much effort would it have taken to have, you know, a little cartoon Harry say, use Emitex, folks, or something along those lines? It's like the back cover isn't representative of them. And when you look at the photo of them, Harry's got his arms folded, looking a bit glum, and the other two are looking away. And it's as though it's their thoughts on the back cover of their first long player.
I'm not even entirely sure if they had any involvement or any say or any, or Milligan was consulted at all about the issuing of this LP.
Quite possibly not, because I can't see any capacity in which, because it's not even a stage photo for the album cover. It's very clearly a BBC photo, although it's not credited as such. So, yeah, it may have just been signed off by their agents or whatever, and they weren't really involved.
Yeah. I mean, I think, because it's the first ever LP issued of actual Goon shows, albeit with the music cut out for rights reasons. But there was this one in October 59, and then the following year they put out The Best of the Goon Shows Volume 2. I much prefer this first one because it's got two really, really strong shows. I don't feel that the next LP that comes out has shows quite so strong.
It doesn't. And also, I don't think it's quite as well presented as this. You mentioned the musical selections are very skillfully edited out. It doesn't disrupt the jokes either side of them. No. Now, the introductions are gone, even though they have feed lines in lines that are still in the show on the record. It doesn't affect that. The only other missing thing, really, is it fades out during the end credits. It's not a music rights thing because you get a bit of the Goon Show theme. It's fading out during the reading of the credits. And I wonder if that might be some kind of legal thing. But also, there were a lot of pauses very subtly slipped out. It's like the BBC Records and Tapes album, the Doctor Who story, Genesis of the Daleks, where, you know, the big question is, how did they cram that onto two sides of vinyl? They cut out every time Tom Baker went, oh, yes. So there's a lot of that. So it races along. And to my ears, it's been very, very, very slightly sped up as well. If you add in what's missing from even just from the version on Radio 4 Extra on the iPlayer at the moment, it doesn't quite add up to the running time it should do, let alone whatever was in the original broadcast, which I'm sure you're going to tell me there were all kinds of very dubious gags that were later removed. I'm guessing, because that is, let's be honest, that is standard practice for the Goons. I had to look, but I couldn't find any reference to any, but I was going to say, sure, you'll enlighten me, but I'm not sure that's really the word.
Well, we'll come to that. But yeah, no, you might be surprised. So, and what about, so you've obviously got this on side one, you've got the episode Dishonored again. On
just build as Dishonored, though,
just build as Dishonored, but it's actually it was because it was a remake of a series 5 show called Dishonored, and the actual series 9 episode that's on the LP was called Dishonored again as a result. But yeah, just called Dishonored on the LP. What did you enjoy that episode as much as Tales of Old Dartmoor, or not quite so much?
Not quite as much for some reason. I know it's by a lot of people considered a one of, if not the definitive Goon show. It just didn't grab me as much, and I'm not sure why. Maybe when they say the story wasn't as familiar, I hadn't been in prison at the age of 6 or whatever, but it's a more relatable thing, you know, the idea of prisoners escaping. You know, it's something you're well used to in fiction. I don't think Dishonored was really, that's more the sort of stuff of films you saw a bit of in the background on Boxing Day when you're trying to play with your toys on the TV with somebody being swashbuckling in them. And it didn't grab me as much. And also, I don't want to get too far into this yet because we will come back to their appearance, I'm sure, but I don't feel the appearance of Eccles and Bluebottle in Dishonored. It's a little more shoehorned in than in Tales of Old Dartmoor, where that's like a part of the, it's like a key plot detail when they appear.
Yeah,
and it is always interesting to see, you know, because I love it. I've always particularly loved it when Bluebottle turns up.
Come on now, who's hiding our prison? Hands up, all those who know anything about this.
Me and Nichols know where he's gone, Captain.
Yeah, we know.
Splendid, lads. Tell me where it is, and I'll reduce your sentence from 2 years to 4.
Well, it went, things. Where did it went? It went in, Eccles.
Yeah?
Do you remember Eccles?
Oh, yeah, I remember Eccles.
Well, does he know where it went in?
I'll ask him. Do you know where it went in?
What does he say, Echo?
He hasn't answered yet. I think he's out.
Curse! What bad luck!
What bad luck!
What bad luck! Shut up, Echo!
Shut up, Echo!
But it's the difference between, there are some of them where they've thought of, you know, clearly Spike has thought, oh, brilliant, I can bring them in there. And others where he's, you know, he's clearly written 90% of the script and thought, I still haven't thought where to put them in. Let's just go back and find an excuse for one of them could be a...
Crowbar them in, yeah.
Yes, yeah. One of them could be an infantryman or something.
Yep.
But it was that, it didn't quite, when I played the second side, have that. Because I didn't know who Eccles and Bluebottle were, but the hysteria that greets them, you know, when the... Me and Eccles knows where it... I've got to stop doing voices on this thing. I'm dreadful. But, you know, you could tell it was something that was a favourite with people. I remember actually looking forward, thinking, did they come into it again? And it doesn't quite work as well. So it never quite held that same sort of magic for me. And, you know, there is the element of I had to hear one of them first. And, if you know, with a lot of things, what you experience first is always going to be not necessarily your actual favourite, but your favourite on an emotive level.
Absolutely, because the first one I ever heard, as I've said many, 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 many times, is the last Smoking Seagoon, which was the last Goon show proper in 1960 ever. And that was the first one I heard, ironically. And most people think it's pretty small beer in terms of, you know, comparing it against some of the mightier titans of Goon show episodes. But I think it's hilarious, warm episode, and it's probably just because of that. Yeah, it was the first one I heard.
Yeah, there's definitely something in that. It's like the way my favourite James Bond film will always be the 1962 Casino Royale. And people think I'm saying that for effect, but that's because I loved that when I was growing up. And I know it's not the best one. I know it's not even that good. But it will always have that association for me.
Well, just on this, because you and I don't think have discussed this before, but the first Blackadder series I saw was the first one in 83.
Mm.
And although I wouldn't say it's my favourite series, I prefer series 2. Series 1 is certainly my second favourite, and most people are pretty sniffy about it, aren't they, generally? But it was my first exposure to those characters, and I think it's brilliant.
Well, and also, it was the talk at the playground at the time. I remember people saying, there's this amazing show on called The Blackadder. And this is going to sound weird, but it's not their fault that the later series were better. Yeah, objectively, they got better and better, up to a point. I mean, I'm not going to include back and forth in that, but it is easy to dismiss something because it is the least good out of a lot of very good things. It's like, when did they know when they last mentioned the Blur album, Leisure, their first album? Which is a top 10 album at the time. It's got There's No Other Way on it. And I remember loving that when it came out, and I remember it being very popular, but because they got better and better, it kind of got sidelined. And does that happen with Goon shows? Are the ones that people disregard because they're not as good as the best or as well-known as the better-known ones, but are perfectly good in their own right?
I'm not sure what the selection criteria was when the BBC, or EMI in this case, started putting out Goon shows on LPs.
It was what we can find, probably.
I think, yeah, it was what was in the BBC archives. So, I mean, there's plenty of what I would class as brilliant, brilliant Goon shows that no one's ever heard of, or, you know, casual listeners have never heard of. I could name a dozen Goon shows that would sit very comfortably on any of those LP releases.
Well, I always quite liked the episode Ned's Atomic Dustbin. And yes, I did, as a 15-year-old, have a phase of liking the band Ned's Atomic Dustbin. I still think Kill Your Television is a tremendous record. Yeah. And Trust, which I think, was that actually, no, Happy was the biggest hit they had, but Trust, I think, is an exceptional single. But it was only because of them that I knew there was a Goon show episode called, God, I can't talk today, a Goon show episode called Ned's Atomic Dustbin. That's not actually a tongue twister, is it? But I somehow made it one. But I always quite liked that one. And it doesn't seem to come round as often. And in fact, it's more likely you find a mention of the band somewhere than that episode.
Yeah. It's funny because I was at school in Belfast in the 90s, early 90s, when Ned's Atomic Dustbin, the band, were at their peak, I guess. And I had friends that were, who were, you know, we were sixth formers at the time, and they were into bands like the Neds and Wonderstuff. And I tried to sort of try to introduce some of my friends who were into Ned's Atomic Dustbin to the Goon Show, because I thought, well, you know, it's a starting point. It's common ground. It's where they derive their name. And it fell flat, as you can imagine. At that time, it was all about Vic Reeves' Big Night Out. You know,
which isn't that far, really. I would not have seen it at the time. But it's a convergence thing. It's like the way, I'm sure in the 60s, if you played I'm a Believer by the Monkees next to Electricity by Captain Beefheart, people would have fainted. Possibly. Yeah. I was shocked. But now, those two records sound a lot closer than they would have done at the time. And I think now, there's a lot about early Vic Reeves, not later on, but that is very Goon Show in some ways.
Oh, absolutely.
But I do think Vic was one of the true originals. I've always had a thing about, he seemed to base his comic universe very early on, you know, that shelf that's at the side of the counter in the newsagents where you have to ask them to get some glowy glue or whatever from it. Or sort of tubes of glitter.
Yeah.
That seemed to be like his world was located there.
it's a great comparison.
But even so, there's a lot more Goon influence in there than I would have credited at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, what are Donald and Davey if they're not sort of
Yeah, that's
distant,
true.
Super intelligent relatives of Blue Bottle.
Yes.
I say super intelligent relatively, but they knew enough to present Film 82 where they look at some of the great films from 1985, which I'm not sure he could have managed. Big Night Out, to an extent, but more The Smell of Reeves and Mortar in particular, there's a lot of cue, as in cue when it's good.
Yeah.
In that, the idea that it's not a programme like another programme, is somehow it is happening and somebody's put a camera there and they're like aware the camera's there and they're just ignoring it and getting on with what they do. You know, like you can see the edges of it in a quite disturbing way. So there is some... And wasn't... Didn't the Q Milligan repeats sort of coincide with the first series of Smell of Reeves and Mortimer?
Mm.
Certainly similar time. And again, I would not have thought at the time they're in any way similar, but I really do see it now.
Yeah, I just think you could imagine, I don't know, think of any random... Okay, it wasn't Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, it was, I think, from Bang Bang series, but Tom Funn and Derek...
Mm.
Any of those sequences, you could see John Bluther and Spike Milligan performing something similar on the Q series.
No, it's 9 a.m. and we've been awake now for 5 hours, having been thrown out of our lodgings due to Derek's rather unconventional way of eating an Arctic roll in the supper room last night. What were you doing, Derek?
I was trying to replicate the way that a pelican might eat the Arctic roll.
I understand entirely now. Well, yes, we're going to have a lot of fun today. We've got our trolley with our cakes and our snouts in
cakes
it.
And snouts.
Lovely.
Mm. Well, I suppose Vic and Bob's genius move was they thought we should just copy that, but with less women with big breasts than Hitler, so nobody Hitler, will yeah. notice.
That's right. And blackface.
No, they didn't avoid that, unfortunately. They are people that seem to have away with that.
Otis Redding, of course.
And don't really. Yeah, and there were a couple of other sketches that were a little bit, in retrospect, a little bit dubious. I don't think people really got that bothered at the time. I'm not saying that as a justification of the whole process, but I think people's minds were on different things at that point, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's odd they seem to somehow skated clean from all that.
Yes,
and,
they
but
have.
That somehow that happens. I mean, I am not going to name names here because you will get really big complaints, but there is one band in particular. Well, there's a couple of 90s bands where I think their lyrics now are very dodgy indeed, but somehow they're all right. And whereas others, you know, I'm trying to think of an example of something that wouldn't get played now, but I'm struggling. I should have come prepared for something that's nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is quite... Well, there you go, you see. You wouldn't see repeats of Q, and the excuse would be given that, you know, oh, well, there's a lot of him doing, you know, pulling slanty eyes and so on. But I could visualise The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer going out uncut and nobody really noticing.
Yeah, because I'm
not saying that's right or wrong in any way. I just think it is interesting that some things, rightly, I suppose, are called up for actions of the past and some aren't.
Yeah, it's funny because I watched it relatively recent. In the last 12 months, I've watched a few episodes of Smell of, because they're great, you know, and it never actually occurred to me. And yet I would, were I to watch, I don't know, Little Britain, that's the obvious one, isn't it? I'd be sucking air in through my teeth and getting all clammy palmed, I suppose.
Well, it's the difficult thing of, I always go back to a thing, Andy Lewis, who's sort of, he was one of the DJs that invented Britpop, but he was a guest on my podcast, Looks Unfamiliar, and we were talking at one point about the goodies, and the phrase he uses is the goodies were, broadly speaking, the goodies. They were at the time, probably they would have been labelled the equivalent of woke at that point. But you watch those shows now, the few bits where there is blackface, or I was going to say the few bits where Bill is chasing women down the street trying to look up their skirts, that happens quite a lot. But things like that stand out all the more because they were on the right side. It's like the Beatles doing "Oh my goodness me, sir" accents. It's like the one or two bits in Python that don't pass muster now. It's because generally, whatever some people involved in certain comedy troupe might be like now, at the time, they were on the right side of a changing society, of a progressive society. And the fact that even then they still couldn't escape, you know, one or two of these less desirable tropes.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, with the goodies, the obvious episode is South Africa, where they went into it doing it with the best intentions, but people reacted rather badly towards it, didn't they?
Well, and I would say the ultimate example of that would be, have you ever seen that was the week that was Black and White Minstrel Show sketch?
Yes, yeah.
Where it's juxtaposed with, you know, news of a lynching that had happened the day before in America. And Millie comes out with a troupe of dancers and they do, you know, a very strong song condemning, you know, the idea of dressing up as black people for entertainment when this sort of thing's happening. But to make their point, in the argo of the time, they use a lot of phraseology that really just feels quite unpleasant now.
Yeah.
And at the time, they were trying to do the right thing. They were saying, stop this. But somehow they look worse in retrospect.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Okay.
So I'm really looking forward to these excise jokes and the tales of old Dartmoor now.
Well, you might be disappointed. Spoilers. So what I always do, listeners who aren't, well, people who aren't listeners, usual listeners to this show, whenever we talk about a Goon show or even a film or anything, I suppose, I like to try and include a little bit of what I call historical context in terms of what was going on in the world when these things were released or went out. And I've got so this show, Tales of Old Dartmoor, written by Spike Milligan on his own, and it's the 21st episode of Series 6, and it was broadcast on the 7th of February, 1956. And from what I could find, I know, Tim, you've done, you've sort of done a bit of your own research and seeing what was going on. Not a huge amount went on in the world on the 7th of February, 1956.
Nope.
So what I've got here is I've got a handful of things that happened around the time that it was broadcast. Okay, so I hope you're not going to see that as cheating. But, I mean, the only thing...
Hey, it's all context.
Well, the only thing I could find, I looked at what was on BBC television on that evening, on the 7th of February, and the only thing I could see that was... that sort of caught my eye. 9:30 p.m. on BBC television. First National Nylon Trade Fair and the Men's Trade Fair. So that was... my mind boggles as to what that involved.
Men's Trade Fair? Was that like Menkind, those shops you get now where, you know, there's those guns that fire foam ping pong balls, lava lamps and replica James Bond cars? But whatever the equivalent was in the 50s.
It sounds really sexy.
Replica Lord Peter Wimsey cars, I don't know.
At the time that this show went out, in the hit parade, number one in the hit parade was 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford. That spent 4 weeks at number one. The day after this went out, the first Routemaster bus in London starts public service, apparently. And 4 days after the show went out, Burgess and McLean surfaced for the first time in Moscow publicly. And that was actually to go on and inspire a Goon show later in the series, actually.
And also, if I can just slip in a quick tribute to him here, Victor Lewis Smith's call to the first McDonald's in Moscow. He was asking if they'd been him recently.
Oh, brilliant. And also, around this time, you might know about this more than me, Shirley Bassey's first single, Burn My Candle, comes out. It was released around this time, but it was banned by the BBC for being too raunchy.
Who's got got a match you're striking. Don't say it all depends. Who wants to help me burn my candle at both ends?
It's always difficult to pinpoint whether these things actually were banned or not. I mean, there's the very odd thing about there are. I've argued with people about this so many times. There are extant recordings of A Day in the Life being played on the Light programme on the BBC, even though it was supposedly banned. And I think sometimes, probably there were things like the BBC said, yeah, we're not sure about this, we'll have to put it on late, or whatever. And the, you know, the record company tried to get publicity out of it. Very few records I'm aware of that were actually banned. It was usually things like, there's a single in the mid-60s called The Addicted Man by The Game, which was kind of an early psychedelic thing, but it was an anti-drug song. But it was about basically a drug addict. And, you know, that got banned, obviously, famously. It was Relaxed by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. But even that was played on, you know, people like Janice Long and John Peel were playing it. It just wasn't on daytime.
Right, yeah.
So I don't really know how banned it would have been. There was probably some, because in those days you couldn't really change the lyrics for radio play. I think that only really became feasible in the early 60s. You could go back and drop another version of a line in. So they probably weren't keen to play it, to put it that way.
No.
And it's probably hyped up to launch this new artist, and it didn't do any harm in the long term, did it?
No. Not at all. And listen, I'm really scraping the barrel here, okay? Born the next day, so born the day after Tales of Old Dartmoor was broadcast, someone who's very much in the news at the moment, the people's hero, BBC chairman Richard Sharp. There you go.
Yeah, I don't really think his proximity to this have much bearing on his later attitude to the BBC, should we say, but...
No. We'll move on. We'll draw a veil. If I was to say the name Samuel James Seymour, would you know who I'm talking about?
Is this... I tried to find out who the MP who became a confidence trickster referred to in the episode was. I found nothing.
Ah, no. So, Samuel James Seymour, and I'll be brief, but it's fascinating, this, okay? So, on the 9th of February, 1956, so 2 days after this episode... on CBS in the States, there was an episode of the TV panel show I've Got a Secret. The host was a guy called Gary Moore. Not the former Thin Lizzy guy. And the whole sort of idea of this panel show was someone would come on with a secret of some description, and the panel tried to guess what it was. Pretty simple, okay? And Seymour, he was something like 96 years old when he appeared on I've Got a Secret.
I've Got a Secret, presented by Winston, the cigarette that changed America's mind about filter smoking. Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should. Now, Winston Filter Cigarettes bring you America's number one panel show, I've Got a Secret, starring Gary Moore.
Now then, sir, will you tell our panel, please? Let's get in a little closer. Do you mind if I pull you in, sir? There we go. Will you tell our panel, please, what your name is and where you're from?
My name's Samuel J. Seymour. I'm from Maryland.
This is Mr. Seymour from Maryland. And we brought Mr. Seymour all the way up from Maryland, and by golly, he got in a hotel and fell down the steps and gave himself a shiner. And we urged him not to come on the show tonight, as a matter of fact, and finally got in touch with his doctor, and the doctor said it was up to Mr. Seymour. Mr. Seymour said he wouldn't miss it. So here he is. I'm feeling apparently pretty well.
Mr. Seymour, would this person have ever been president of the United States?
Was he ever president, this man?
Oh, I think he was once.
Would it have been Abraham Lincoln?
It was Abraham Lincoln, yes.
You witnessed something to do with Abraham Lincoln. Was this a pleasant thing?
Was it a pleasant thing you saw, sir?
Not very pleasant, I don't think. I was scared to death, over.
He said, no, he was scared to death.
Would it have had anything to do with the President Lincoln's death, by any chance?
Unfortunately, yes.
Did Mr. Seymour witness the shooting of President Lincoln?
He'd been taken to Ford's Theatre by his godmother to see our American cousin, okay? And he said, all of a sudden a shot rang out and someone in the president's box screamed. I saw Lincoln slumped forward in his seat. And then he said he watched John Wilkes Booth jump from the box to the stage, and he didn't really understand, because he was too young, what was happening. And he was actually quite concerned about Booth because he'd broke his leg as he was making his escape.
Well, I do know something else that went out on the day that this actual episode went out.
Go on.
Which is, I went and looked this up. In the episode, there's a reference to alerting the prisoners to the fact that Listen with Mother is on at 2:30. Which it was, that day's story, read by Julia Lang, was Galloper and the Bouncer and Daisy by Margaret E. Jacobson, who wrote a lot of stories to Listen with Mother. I can't find anything more out than that, but I would suspect they were some kind of woodland animals and that possibly their adventures did not live up to the excitement-related promise of their names.
No.
It's usually the case.
I would very much doubt that they would.
They probably made, well, actually, if one of them was called Daisy, they wouldn't make Daisy chains. It was always that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. One other thing, Tim, I was looking at the number of times that this has been released on, you know, various sort of iterations of LPs and cassettes over the years. It was actually released on 8-track in the 70s?
What? I can't see many sort of heads crouched around a bong in the early 70s listening to Tales of Old Dartmoor.
Yeah. It was repeated only the once. See, this is the thing. I was doing my research here thinking that, because it's such a well-known show, because it was issued on LP, I assumed it would have been repeated several times if not in the late 50s, you know, into the 60s and into the 70s. And it was repeated the one time after its first broadcast.
Did you find the thing that I stumbled across while trying to find that out?
Are we talking Monday Night at Home?
Tales of Old Dartmoor by Mr. F.J. Harris.
What?
This was a programme that was on, you know, before they had the four proper BBC... Actually, it was three at that point, wasn't it? BBC National Channels, or all these stations called things like BBC LI and BBC LO and so on. One of them had, on the 11th of October 1926, Tales of Old Dartmoor by Mr. F.J. Harris, who appears to have been, you know, one of those historians who got around then that wrote about 5 million books or things like Taps and Their Pipes.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, I cannot find out anything about the content of the programme. Probably nothing survives of it beyond the title, but it is interesting that there had been this programme 30 years beforehand with the same title. And that is the only other iteration of that title that I can find.
That's wonderful. Okay.
So I've confused it with Monday Night at Home, which of course was the show that Gerard Hoffnung was on quite a lot. So I'm not surprised to find there's a Goons connection.
Well, so Tales of Old Dartmoor wasn't repeated until the 90s, actually. Apart from this one time in November 59, as part of Monday Night at Home, they played, I'm not sure if they played the whole episode, but
it will have been an excerpt if it was Monday Night at Home.
Yeah, yeah.
It might even, what date was it? Because it could even have been the album.
23rd, well, this is the thing, Tim. This is a bit of a swizz, I think, for Goons fans, because it was the 23rd of November 59, and the album had come out the month before.
Yeah. It will have been that, I think.
Yeah. It's billed as a selection of recorded wit, music and humour. And we've got, I won't read it all out, but we've got Louis Armstrong and Danny Kaye doing Saints. We've got Ivor Cutler doing Gruts for Tea.
Okay. Oh, right, yes.
And I imagine a very young Jane Asher doing Lobster Quadrille.
Oh, from which? Is that Alice in Wonderland or Alice Through the Looking Glass? It's one of them, isn't it? Yeah.
Not sure. It's Jane Asher with Ian Wallace and Norman Shelley.
Mr. Sellers, throw away that fur-lined chin strap and make a statement.
What is a jailbreak?
Answer, a break used for stopping jails.
Wrong! A jailbreak has nothing to do with tonight's story, which is entitled Tales of Old Dartmoor.
So Ned Segun is governor of Dartmoor Prison, and he is facing unemployment, or the danger of unemployment, because he's got no convicts left in the prison. And Gritpipe and Moriarty arrive and offer to supply him with convicts at the rate of 3 shillings per head per day. And he agrees to this, and hijinks ensue.
Men, ladies, and gentlemen, it is indeed a great pleasure to welcome you to Dartmoor Prison. Thank you. You will find we have a great tradition here. And I don't want a single one of you to feel you're not wanted.
What do you mean they're not wanted? These men are wanted everywhere.
Really? Who the devil wants this lot?
The police.
Well, they're safe here.
Good.
All right, men. Off to your cells now. Don't forget, listen with Mother at 2:30.
Bye-bye.
Yes, once again, Dartmoor Prison was chock full as of old. And the prison yard rang to the happy sound of rock-breaking mailbag sewing and warder bashing.
I did notice one interesting cultural reference you may be ahead of me on.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a reference to Harry of your record hasn't reached the hit parade.
Yes.
And he did have an EP out at that point.
Yep.
Called the Harry Seacombe EP, which is English language versions of opera songs, including Ness and Dormer. And what's interesting was my first reaction was to think, yeah, as if that was going to reach the hit parade. But when you think about it, really, most of the Goons takes place not quite pre-rock and roll, but you would not have heard much rock and roll on the BBC, and therefore not really anywhere at all, because, you know, ITV was only gradually rolled out throughout the 50s. And, you know, that's where you get the situation where some of the early Goon appearances were only shown in some regions.
Mm.
And so a lot of the stuff in the charts, when you think of Here in My Heart by Al Martino, the first ever number one single in the UK.
Yeah.
Isn't that far removed from this kind of opera stuff? Mario Lanza was massive. So that's what pop music was like. And in fact, if you look at the Goon Show as a whole, I know there's Blood Knot's Rock and Roll Call, which is a very early and on the money rock and roll pastiche, and, you know, later you get Peter Sellers's kind of pastiche records and so on, but how little reference there is throughout to pop stars and pop songs of the day. And you compare it to, you know, 10 years later, you know, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore have John Lennon guesting in sketches on their shows.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Pop music is part of general comedic discourse by that point, but it wasn't in the 50s, and Milligan remained very sniffy. I mean, obviously Sellers wasn't, because, you know, he liked a bit of messing about with pop stars. He recorded with the Hollies and Steel Eye Span and so on, but Milligan always remained very grumpy about it. I remember seeing an interview with him in the 80s. I'd love to, you know, track this down just to read it again and see if the context looks any different to me, but he went on a rant about piped pop music. Now, that is a little bit old man yells at cloud, because even in the 80s, you might have got piped music in places, but it wasn't pop music. It wasn't even old pop music.
No.
That did not happen. So, that, you know, that's real curmudgeon stuff. But even when he was on... Was it on Room 101? When he was just... just so awful about the Rolling Stones. Or was that an interview in Loaded? I don't remember
that. No, I've not watched Room 101 for years, but that episode, I mean.
Oh, but, Room 101. I can't remember why, but he said, where do you go after a song like Yesterday? Is this summation about pop music should have stopped there?
He loved Yesterday. That was
when he was interviewed in Loaded. He was just, the Stones were just noise and everyone stood the appeal. No, they were noise. That was the whole point, but... aside from the seismic influence they had on British culture in the 60s, they made some really good records.
Up until what's the cutoff point? About 73, maybe?
I would go along with that. Yeah, I quite like It's Only Rock and Roll. I like stuff from throughout their career, I'll be honest about that. I mean, a couple of years ago, I did that thing, the Vintage Rock Stone special, and I insisted on writing the features on the 80s albums because I thought it's much more of a fun challenge to find good things to say about them than it is, you know, anyone could, and my cat could write about Exile on Main Street, and that's what it is, but, you know, to find something positive to say about Dirty Work, that was, I got an immense amount of satisfaction from that.
Okay, we've drifted onto the Rolling Stones.
We have, yes, yeah.
Okay.
So we'll snap back to Harry and his unsuccessful EP.
Yes, because he'd had a single out, On With The Motley, which had reached number 16. In 55, so the year before. They were always very gently pulling his leg about his musical career on that show, you know.
And he must have been so good humoured about that, because you would, if I was in his shoes, I'd say three times before I snapped back, had any good divorces lately.
Yeah. Well, they would make fun of his almost addiction to motor cars. Peter Sellers' addiction to motor cars.
Yes, yeah.
And he was quite happy to play along with that. Just on Seacombe's singing voice, though, there's a brilliant sequence in this where Seacombe bursts into song.
It was a wonderful experience to be jogging along the Queen's Highway in one of Her Majesty's prisons on this fine morning. Get up there! A gypsy am I, I travel the road, who cares? The lark in the sky, to bid you goodbye, I travel the road!
You silly, twisted governor.
This episode I first heard through my dad. Not actually, I didn't physically hear it. My dad used to quote lines from it when I was growing up without really attributing it to the Goons. He would play out these scenes from this episode. We never had the LP in the house, or certainly not when I was growing up. So I can only assume that he would have heard it when he was a younger man. Maybe a friend had it, and, you know, used to listen to it fairly regularly. But it did make quite a mark on my dad, because he would, you know, there was a number of lines. He would try to explain to me the sequence with the cigarettes between Harry and Grippipe, which is brilliant. But it doesn't really translate when you've got your father trying to explain it to you. And I found out, because I looked at the original script that was Spike's script on the night of recording, and it's interesting because the script, unlike many Goon shows, the script for this episode sticks, or what was recorded sticks very closely to what was in the script, more or less. Okay, with a few exceptions, and one of them actually was that the sequence where Grippipe says, "Neddy, I have a strange request," and then whispers, and then you know the sequence I mean. I'll play the clip. In the actual script, he says, "Neddy, I have a strange request, but before I start, have you a cigarette?" And in the script, Harry says, "Of course, I'll get you one." And then we have the sequence where he opens the iron door, bolts are withdrawn, iron door opened, footsteps down long horror corridor, etc., etc. And then he comes back, and in the script he says, "Sorry, I've run right out." And Grippipe says, "Pity, I'll have to smoke one of my own." Okay? So that was how it was originally going to be. And I think very sensibly on the night, because you can see where Spike's crossed it all out and changed it, they went with what was, you know, in the actual recording, which I think works a hell of a lot better.
I think it does. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I love a great bit of, you know, extraneously long sound effect.
Yes.
I'm one of the few people who used to love it when... Do you ever listen to Richard Herring's As It Occurs to Me?
Yes.
When he would have the roulette wheel going on for ages.
Yeah.
And I was one of the people who bought the CD of the roulette wheel going on for 75 minutes. Which, when you put it into iTunes, comes up as something ridiculous, like some like specific recording of an opera.
I used to listen to that. Tiny Andrew Collins was kind of Blue Bottle, wasn't he?
Yes. It didn't sound that dissimilar either.
I don't know if that was Dan Tetzel.
Yes, yeah.
You asked me earlier, you said, you know, how much was cut out from the original recording? And I want to tell you, hardly anything was cut out.
Okay.
So what, I mean, other than the links sort of introducing Max and Ray and a couple of sort of musical cues, it's pretty much what went out was what was issued on LP. There were no cuts to speak of. So that's quite interesting as well. And I wonder, again, during, you know, part of the selection criteria was, let's find a show that, you know, we can just cut out the music, but we don't have to do much in the way of trimming it.
That would make sense, actually.
Mm.
So we're really down to a very narrow selection there. We don't, what actually is to hand in the sound archives? On tape, would have had to be a tape as well, not a transcription services disc.
That's right.
And what doesn't have stuff that we need to remove? So, well, you're looking at a choice of, I'm going to say this as an educated guess, probably around that time, about a dozen shows would have been available.
What, available that didn't need cutting? Is that what you mean?
And were actually excellent, you know, known to be excellent on tape and easily to hand.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that's based on knowledge of the state of the, well, I say the sound archive at that point, a lot of it was kept by separate departments, which is why, you know, every so often now on Radio 4 Extra, you know, you'll hear something being repeated and say, until recently it was lost.
Mm.
And it's because, you know, nobody knew where it was. Somehow they've recently found, when they used to play the first series of Delve Special, the Stephen Fry series, the first series of Shift and Scandal, first couple of broadcasts on, well, it was BBC 7 at that point, but 4 Extra, they used offers that I got hold of from a collector to broadcast because they couldn't find the original tapes, and they've now been located.
Right.
Probably when the building was vacated or something. So they now play them off the masters.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I would imagine there were many, many Goon shows that, you know, they were able to choose from with, you know, just on a practical level.
Saying that though, you look at the B side of this, you got Dishonored and you've got Milligan doing an Indian accent in that.
True, yes.
So,
and that I was about to slightly change the subject and say, did we know if the Beatles owned the copy? And maybe they did, if it's got one of those accents on it.
Yeah. You mentioned Python before. So you've listened to the full version with Max and Ray, I'm guessing.
Yes.
For the purposes of this. Okay. So in introducing Max Galdray, and this wasn't on the LP, you've got Grip Pipe, who says,
in fact, hardly room for even a Max Galdray type Max Galdray to play his nylon dog cardigan and plastic mule race.
Yes, which of course appears in Election Night Special in Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yes, it does.
John Cleese asks if there's an update on it.
What do you make of the nylon dog cardigan and plastic mule rest?
There's no such thing!
Thank you, Spike.
But that would be perfectly understandable if it was part of the LP, if it was on the LP that was commercially released. You could understand that. But this show had gone out once in 56 and then an excerpt in 59 on Monday Night at Home.
Is that phrase never used anywhere else?
No. So I'm wondering whether they could have remembered one of the, you know, one of the Pythons could have remembered the line from when it first went out, or maybe taped it themselves, or somehow got a recording of it, or jotted it down. Maybe they were writing their own sort of Goon Show scripts around that time and copied it. You know, I don't know, but it's weird that exact line should turn up again. Some 15 plus years later, is it?
Maybe you should ask Eric Idle on Twitter.
Yeah, might do that.
That is really weird, though. If it was only used that one, I had just assumed it does crop up in other shows.
No.
Okay.
No. So I might. Yeah, I might tweet Eric Idle and see if he replies, and then ask him on the show. Are there any particular bits of this that stand out for you as your, you know, when you were first listening to this, that, you know, you would play again and again? Any particular sequences that you liked more than
definitely
others?
The appearance of Eccles and Bluebottle.
Yeah.
I actually, do you know what? I know the one people go for is what time is it, Eccles. I think this is for the sheer, just the, I couldn't believe the imagination when I first heard it. You know, do you remember Eccles? Oh, yeah, I remember Eccles. It's just such an odd yet obvious sort of leap of logic. And it really works. Although I did genuinely, until I read the script, when Eccles repeats sort of Blue Bottle's use of the word wented, when he says, do you know where it wented? I actually thought he said, do you know where it went, Eck? As in short for Eccles. And I'm still not 100% convinced that isn't it.
Well, yeah, but, well, we'll come on to Telly Goons in a bit. if we must. another cultural reference that I didn't know who the guy was, but I worked out the gag. Occasionally, don't know if you're the same, when you were younger, you'd work out a gag even though you didn't know the person or the reference.
Well, looking at Python, Reginald Maudling, I had no idea who he was or what he'd done, but it was obvious he was a politician that they didn't like much. And it's much easier. You know, when people say, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of topical things in Not the 9 o'clock News that even, you know, as somebody who wrote the sleeve notes of the issues, the albums, I think, still think, what were they on about there? But, you know, it is easy to understand archetypes. You know the sort of person Sir Robert Mark represents. And it is the same with things like this. Because I'm wondering who you're going to mention now, because there's a few names in this.
Well, you just mentioned Not the 9 o'clock News. One of my favourite lines ever from that. And I had no idea who Nye Bevan was, but there's the guy in, is it the Question Time?
Yes.
I wonder what Nye Bevan would have done.
He would have hacked his pants.
No, in this, it's David Nixon, because they...
Yeah.
So, I better just give a bit of context in case people need me to, you know. But so they decide, so we've got this prison full of, Dartmoor prison full of convicts that Gripipe and Moriarty have rustled up. The prisoners want to go on holiday, so they decide to go to France. They sail the prison to the Chateau d'If, where guest arrangements have been made. They discover Bloodknocker stowed away during the voyage. And Bloodknock, Gripipe and Moriarty are all anxious to gain entry to the Chateau d'If because it contains a clue to the location of the treasure of the Count of Monte Cristo. I'll come back to that in a minute, but it ends up that Bloodknock commandeers the Dartmoor prison, I think, and sails it away, and they pursue him in the Chateau d'If. And at one point, one of the sailors shouts,
"Prison on the starboard bow!
Gad, it might be the Dartmoor! Get my telescope out of its cell! Thank you! By Gad, yes, it is!
Sapristi, yes, look at that flag! It's flying the skull and crossbone!
Wrong! It's a photograph of David Nixon with his arms folded!"
Now, I thought that was hilarious because I could work it out that it was a very thin man.
Well, that's if you look at the early 70s, the similar comedy references to Sir Alec Douglas Hume.
Yes.
And I didn't know anything about him until I was much older, but it was quite obvious. You know, his name gives away he was either aristocracy or a politician. And, you know, he looks a bit bony.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you work it out because these days, I don't want to sound like one of these people who moans about these days. You've got to, you know, but these days it would be spoon-fed to you. But by the way, yeah, getting back to the Count of Monte Cristo, I think Spike at the time must have been reading or the Count of Monte Cristo was sort of in the air at the time. I know that they serialised on ITV a couple of weeks after the show, the Count of Monte Cristo, with Mickey Dolenz's father in the title role. As I say, the reason why I think it was on Spike's mind around this time because in the show called Fred, which was, maybe 3-4 months after this, they do a Count of Monte Cristo pastiche. So maybe he'd read it around this time. But It was just unusual. I just thought it was quite unusual that they actually reference an actual literary work rather than just coming up with a comedy goonish French prison, you know?
Yes. Yeah, that is a little atypical now that you mention it.
Mm. Is it time now, do you think, to talk about the Tally Goons?
Well, I just wanted to say, first of all, the other references were there's Bernard Miles Sir, as in Sir Bernard Miles, which again was something I understood because, it was obviously somebody who was known for those sort of voices. But the one that confused me is that it was much older was Sabrina.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had no idea who Sabrina was when I first heard it. And then in the 80s, the jokes in the Goons are always like by the measurements of Sabrina. And there was Sabrina Salerno who sang, boys, 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 I'm looking for a good time, etc. And it just seemed very weird that there was clearly some kind of historical analogue to her. And obviously, it was difficult to find out these things at that time. There wasn't the internet, so you couldn't look up Sabrina. Although, had it existed then, you would have got the video for Boys Summertime Love. Freeze frames of the bit in the pool and so on. But
I know the one. My cousin lived in the same apartment block in London as...
Really?
Yeah. I don't think he could afford it, but he found the money just so he could bump into her in the corridor,
I didn't find any proper information about Sabrina, the 50s UK model, until much, much later, because there weren't biographies of her or anything. So, that was always a strange thing. But there's also, we've not really mentioned the two musical selections, and I know you normally... I'm going to assume you've not asked me this because the answer will be obvious, but you normally ask people, do you skip the musical bits?
Oh, of course.
No,
I haven't asked that. No, go
I
on.
Never do. I never right. did. Mm. I always liked both Max Geldray and Ray Ellington. I prefer Max, to be honest with you, but I'm very fond of particularly film soundtrack music from that era anyway. But what is odd is there is this kind of perceived idea that they were sort of, although they got on well with the Goons, they fitted into the show, they were sort of, they weren't really part of it, they were forced on them, and, it was the BBC's idea of a jolly good time, what people liked, to have as entertaining music in the middle of a programme. But again, it's what was in the charts. It's literally the same as what you would have heard on the like programme's music shows. And what is interesting is, Ray Ellington does the Tender Trap, which is a theme from a huge romantic comedy the previous year, starring Frank Sinatra and Debbie Reynolds, who originally sang it. So, that's as close as you can get to somebody doing, a Harry Styles song in the middle of a comedy show at the moment. And also, Max Geldray does Who's Sorry Now, which... It starts off a bit BBC Test Card F, but it gets genuinely exciting when it speeds up. When he does his usual trick of suddenly playing it really fast.
Yes.
But that obviously was a bit of a standard by that point. I think, isn't it in one of the Marx Brothers films and a couple of things? But a couple of months after this, Connie Francis did a new kind of post-rock and roll version, which is a huge hit. And I've genuinely tried to find if her or any of her management had been in the UK around the time this went out.
Yeah.
It's not impossible.
Yeah.
Because one of my big things, this is a real diversion, but there's a singer, songwriter from the 60s I'm very keen on called Tim Buckley.
Who has
a song called Happy Time, which he originally did on a visit to the UK when it was called Coming Home to Stay on Late Night Lineup. After he's done that, and he goes back to America to record it for Blue Afternoon, his next album, it suddenly acquires a closing chord, which is exactly the same as the closing chord for the closing theme of Campbell-Witt Green, the BBC animated lunchtime children's show. And I do genuinely think, because, there was less television in those days, and anyone visiting might have watched whatever was on. It wasn't like the channels to choose on, particularly in the middle of the day. So I wonder if he saw it and thought, Portlanto. It's not impossible.
Okay.
I say it was remote chance, but it's not impossible that Connie Francis did Who's Sorry Now because of the Goon Show.
Right. I mentioned Count of Monte Cristo on ITV with the Count played by Mickey Dolenz's father. Randy Scouse Git, the song. Is it true that one of the monkeys, I'm assuming Davy, was in England in the whatever year it would have been, 66, 67, and saw an episode of Till Death Us Do Part and was inspired?
I believe it was Mickey that suggested calling it Randy Scouse Git, and then he was forced to change it to get, well, ironically, given what we're saying earlier, to get played on the radio. He called it alternate title.
Yeah. So it was Mickey. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So these things did go in.
Yeah. And, okay, by this point, Lennon obviously probably wasn't listening religiously to The Goon Show. Well, may have been. Yeah, he was listening to The Goon Show up until probably around this time, 56, 57. Listening to probably more Ray Ellington. And you wonder if there was any subliminal influence on him.
Oh, I think almost certainly. You only have to look at, you know, I know a lot of stuff they did in their career was goonish, but I assume you've read Mark Lewisohn's Tune In, the first volume of his Beatles biography. Some of the running jokes they have between them when they're still in the Quarrymen and Silver Beatles are very goon. Before, you know, even before, when you would have just heard the goons on the radio, you know, there wasn't really celebrity culture then, but it clearly sunk in. The one that always strikes me was, there's something about Paul had the guitar with the sticker saying guaranteed not to split, which him and John used to laugh at. And George made a joke about it, said, oh, Bayek, it hasn't, or something like that. That was one of the things that bonded. And that's quite goon to laugh at, you know, a sticker that isn't actually that funny in itself. But it incongruousness is what makes it amusing.
They were the Nurk twins very briefly, weren't they?
Yeah.
But Fred Nurk was certainly a very minor character that would turn up in The Goon Show. So I wonder whether they picked it up from that or not. Sorry, have you got any more to say about Ray or Max?
No, just I think you're absolutely right. Because there is some crossover with some numbers they did very early on in the career. I don't think they ever did It's Only a Paper Moon. I used to have a thing about... I think that's performed in one show by Max Geldray, but I remember thinking as sort of, an amusement to myself, it's only a paper moon whenever I hear The Goon Show. But
Have you heard Ray Ellington's version of Jingle Bells?
I don't believe I have, no.
Which was on... The Greenslade Story.
Oh, I will have heard it, yes, yeah.
Where Ray decides that he's going to start barking throughout the song and gets the quartet to bark as well. Mm. It's quite something.
Have you ever heard the Beatle Barkers?
No.
It's a genuine record from the 60s with Beatles songs done by barking dogs. It's like, rah, 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 rah.
Have you heard that record from, I don't know, the 60s probably? A parrot singing I Left My Heart in San Francisco?
I can't say I have.
That's...
Is it an actual parrot or is it a bald engineer?
An actual parrot, apparently.
Is it as successful as that rave record where they use bits of Sid James' dialogue to have him covering Bike by Pink Floyd? That's real. That's genuine. It doesn't quite... The wonders of modern technology weren't quite up to it at that point.
That sounds very special. So, the Telegoons.
Yes, the Telegoons.
For anyone who doesn't know, was a puppet show from 63, two series, 63, 64, short adaptations of Goon shows. adapted by the writer Maurice Wiltshire, and the voices of Sellers, Seacombe and Milligan again, re-recorded episodes, or re-recorded soundtracks. And the puppets, I'd ask you first, Tim, how successful were the puppets in terms of realising the characters, do you think?
I don't know. I think Blue Bottle actually kind of looks how I'd always imagined him. Some of the others, I remember the first time I saw the Telegoons, it was a BBC Two programme in the mid-80s called Windmill, which is basically theme series of clips sort of called from the BBC's Windmill Road film and videotape library. And I can't remember what the theme was. It was a clip of the Telegoons with Neddy being pushed out of a train. And I remember thinking it was hilarious, the pathetic way that the puppet looks so much like Harry Seacombe. So some of them capture them and some of them don't. But I remember you saying on the previous occasion I appeared in this, the puppets look like they've been dragged out of a canal. And, you know, they did actually adapt the episode The Canal as well. Which they are.
Yeah.
And I will also say, have you ever seen, I occasionally post this on Twitter, but there's an advert from TV Comic in the 50s for Blue Bottle and Eccles glove puppets you can send off for. And the really unfortunate thing about it is, right, these things cost 9 shillings and 11 pence. So it's got them with the speech bubble saying, send 9/11. Is that an appropriate response to those terrifying puppets?
No, I'm with you. I think Blue Bottle is actually, I think it's the best they could do. You're never going to be able to summon up what's in your mind's eye in terms of the characters. But I think Seagoon is more or less how I would imagine Seagoon to look. Blue Bottle is probably the best approximation of that character. I don't think Eccles and Moriarty, they just look horrifying. And Grippipe.
Do you know what? There's a lot of pages out there with people trying to track down the original puppets.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable for two reasons. One, who would want to come face to face with them?
No.
But two, the common thread seems to be people saying they were last seen in a pub. I assume means on display in the pub somewhere, but it sounds like they're saying these puppets went off for a drink.
They needed it.
Yes.
I rewatched Tales of Old the Telegoons Tales of Old Dartmoor, obviously, for this, and jotted down a few things. I'm sure you picked up on these. Did you? Am I right? It was the picture quality was pretty poor. I'm sure that in Moriarty's prison cell on the wall there was a topless woman.
It looked like it. Yes. Yeah.
For what is a was it a Saturday tea time show?
It was. Yeah. Famously, it was scheduled. Was it before or after Doctor Who when it first started?
Before.
Yes. And, well, there is a weird parallel, which is mentioned in Campbell-Witt Green before. The follow-on series, Trumpton, Chippy Minton, the carpenter, who is quite kind of proto-UKIP guy in a lot of respects. He's very impatient with women and so on. If you look closely on his workshop wall, obviously it's not topless women, but he's got, you know, bathing beauties pinned up. Cut out from a newspaper, which is obviously, you know, authentic character depth. But I was really surprised when I noticed that.
Maybe back at that time, in those days,
people didn't notice.
You might suppose most young kids, if they went into their father's shed, you know, there's bound to be some risque pictures pinned to the wall.
And also, wasn't in an independent production, so there wasn't anyone at the BBC saying, stop that, you. But yeah, the picture quality is dreadful.
It is.
Where do these prints come from? Who are they with at the moment? I'm urging a Blu-ray release, I hasten to add. But
I think they were sourced from a budgie's cage, because they are pretty rotten. I am hopefully going to be speaking later this year to, I think it's fair to say, possibly a world authority on the Telegoons. I'm not going to give it.
It's not one of the puppets, is it?
No.
I'm safe.
He's probably got a few, though, I'm sure, tucked away somewhere. I'm going to be talking to him because obviously it's the 60th anniversary of the Telegoons this year. So I'm hoping to get a lot more information about, you know, the whereabouts of the puppets and all the rest of it. Couple more things. This episode of the Telegoons, like all of the episodes of Telegoons, were recorded. They weren't going out live, were they? But what I don't understand then, there's a bit when Seagoon is writing an entry in the prison diary, and he fluffs his line.
Entry in prison diary. Convict Brit...
Try again, Eddie.
Thank you. Entry in prison diary. Convict Brit Pipefin made a strange request today.
Eddie. Eddie, may I have a strange request?
And then, because presumably Sellers was not available to record the line, try again, Neddy, as Gritpipe, Milligan, you can tell it's Milligan, says, try again, Neddy. And Seagoon says the line correctly. I don't understand why that was included.
Would it have been to do with the fact that, I mean, was it originally made on videotape or film? That would be the key thing here, because in those days, things had to be recorded as live. And that's one of the reasons there were so many problems with the untransmitted Doctor Who pilot, the first version, the first episode, was that they fluff a couple of lines, the TARDIS doors spring open mid-scene, and there was no option but to carry on recording.
Right.
And I know they very nearly, because Play School had to be recorded as live, they very nearly let Johnny Ball go at the end of his first week because he caused an edit to the tape every day that week. So it could be that, you know, this wouldn't even be being made at the BBC. There probably wouldn't have been the facilities or the budget to edit it. So they probably just ploughed ahead in some weird little independent studio somewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
isn't it called like Cheapo Films or something, the company that made it?
Grosvenor. Sounds highfalutin, doesn't it? There's also
probably some shady bloke to the back of Soho somewhere.
It's quite weird when you see actual human hands masquerading as puppet hands as well, isn't it?
Yes, that was always something a bit weird about, because Gerry and Sylvia Anderson did that as well.
Yeah.
Mm. Obviously, you know, shots where a puppet could not have picked up something as crucial to the plot. Sometimes it is human hands. And it is very odd when that happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's 14, 15 minutes long. Sticks very close to the original script.
There's not much missing, is there?
No. And it's obviously been adapted from the actual original script, because it includes a line that wasn't in the recording but was in the script. Where they say, by evening each convict had dismantled his old cell, carried the bricks into the chateau wrapped in brown paper and labelled accordingly, and taken a red wine shower. And in the actual recording, they don't include the red wine shower.
No
line.
And it opens with a completely different scenario as well, where they're trying to sell a Picasso in the pawn shop.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't get that.
No, it doesn't seem to actually. The joke itself doesn't seem to make any sense.
It doesn't.
But I'll tell you the one thing that really struck me watching it was that, I say one of the things that lets it down, I mean, that the whole thing, I can't really say it's a misconceived idea, because it was for kids, you know. Yeah. It probably entertained them just fine in 1963. But one of the real weak links in the chain is the music. It's just ordinary, sort of stop music type music. Yeah. Whereas in the Goon Show itself, one of the things, well, there's a perfect example in Tales of Old Dartmoor. The music when they set sail is so similar to what you would have heard in, you know, a British film as a longboat sets off around that time, but just tweaked enough, just exaggerated enough to be funny, you know, to be kind of, this is sailing music. And with this, it's just there. And it doesn't do much to enhance the on-screen action, which badly, badly needs enhancing.
It's done on the cheap. You could tell they were trying to fill time as well when they had those prisoners marching into the prison, and it went on just too long. So, yeah, overall, Telegoons was not as successful. I mean, it must have been successful enough because it got two series.
But, well, like I say, it was probably perfectly well enjoyed in its time. It's just, it is something that has not worn well.
No. But possibly, if we got a really decent transfer.
it might look slightly less rancid.
Yeah. Okay, so is there anything else that you want to touch on before we wrap up?
To be honest with you, I think I've... Given that my main fixation is with the album version, I have pretty much exhausted it, to be honest with you. Just looking at the album sleeve now, see if there's anything else of note on it. There's not really, apart from a very Gilliam-esque pointing hand.
Yeah.
Which is pointing at nothing in particular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's an odd parallel as well.
Tim, it's as always, it's been wonderful having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, Looks Unfamiliar. What have you got coming up? Have you got any particular special guests we should be aware of?
I'm working on a couple of interesting names. Let's just say that. I never like to, because it takes me so long to edit them, announce guests in advance. But no, there might be a couple of quite interesting names coming up. I always like to have a mix of guests. I like to have, you know, well-known people, but people have just discovered on Twitter as well, where I've thought, you're quite funny, you could do it. So, yeah, just keep an eye out. Can I get a plug in for Top of the Box Volume 2?
Of course.
Which is my book about covering the story behind every album released by BBC Records and Tapes, which does cover a lot of Goon material, not just the Goon Show Classics albums, but also the Spike Milligan's Record Load of Rubbish. There was, do you know about Goon Show Hits? Ray Ellington re-recording some of his contributions to the show. Have you ever seen the cover of that?
Yeah, he's a convict.
He's a convict with sort of solarized images of the goons laughing at him, which doesn't really play well in this day. He looks very unhappy about the whole affair as well. But there's also several iterations of the Peter Sellers Parkinson interviews were issued, but Parkinson Meets the Goons came out a couple of times, including one cover where they had an imprint called Weekend Sounds, where they reissued previous albums very cheaply. Yeah. Have you seen the Weekend Sounds cover of Parkinson Meets the Goons?
I will have done. I can't bring it to
mind. It's a terrible photo montage where they've got shovels for some reason. And there's a huge Michael Parkinson. It looks like they're driving shovels into him. I don't understand what was going on, but there's a lot about there's the Sheba Sound, who were frequent guests on Q. They did an album for BBC Records and Tapes. Quite a lot in there. And you'll find so much more non-Goon related that the main reason I wrote it was I loved finding out about all these long forgotten things, like who was Freddie Griswood, things like who was Sir Malcolm Sargent, you know, who got albums themselves very early on. And, you know, finding out, I have tracked down where 99% of the tracks on the BBC Radiophonic Workshop albums come from. Well, again, there's a Goon link there because obviously Major Bloodknock's stomach is on a few of them, but it took so much work to work out where some of those, because, you know, those albums had like 40, 50 tracks on them. Those local radio signature tunes came from, and I've managed to locate most of them. So I really would say, if you are interested in the sort of stuff that is covered on Goon Pod, you will find genuinely, I'm not just saying that because I want people to buy copies, you will really get a lot out of this book because you may even understand some cultural references in the Goons that,
absolutely,
you know, are names that are now sort of faded from, you know, public consciousness. So, yeah, that it's all at timworthington.org. Anything else you think I should plug?
Well, are you writing anything now, or what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on, I occasionally do collected anthologies of things that I've written. I'm doing one of them at the moment. I have an idea for something to come after that, something more factual, which I don't want to say too much about at the moment, but that's kind of about 70% done. That's been another long-term project.
Okay.
And again, it involves the BBC in the 50s and 60s.
Brilliant.
And given that the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who is coming up, I may have some Doctor Who-related ideas as well.
Brilliant. Excellent. Of course, yeah, because that's coming up as well as... I mean, it might be overshadowed somewhat by the Telegoons anniversary.
I was just imagining that. They did a three-part Telegoon special. With Neil Patrick Harris as Blue Bottle. In fact, I really want that to happen now.
Oh, make it happen. I might dream of that tonight.
It might be slightly better quality as well.
Yeah.
They could do the puppets in CGI, but oh, that isn't worth thinking about.
Oh, well, Tim, thank you once again. And I'm sure at some point in the future... By the way, one last quick point I want to make. I meant to say this right at the beginning, and I'm saying it right at the end. This is officially... the 100th episode of Goonpod.
Wow. Well, I had no idea of that, so I am quite honoured. Do you know what? Your mileage may vary, listeners. You might not be thinking the same, but I can't think of a better way to celebrate the 100 than with something that was the only permanent reminder at the time of the Goon Show.
Mm.
It was the only bit of it you could own and listen to again and again. Because we can't really count the singles...
No.
In that, because they weren't really the show. And the fact that, you know, this has stood the test time, you can still buy it on CD in HMV. You genuinely can.
Mm.
In fact, I did check earlier today, and yes, you can.
Yep.
And it, in some ways, in some regards, it's the most important Peter Goon's memorabilia. And so I'm very glad to be marking this occasion with that.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Because, but arguably, without this LP, a lot of people may have overlooked the Goon Show, may have not really carried, you know, because it finished the year after. People may have just given up on it, and it may have, to some degree, faded into obscurity.
It's entirely possible, yeah.
Yeah, so...
So, yeah, we should then actually apologise and say thank you to... Doug Geddes, because, you know, maybe his sleeve notes played their part after all. And absolutely. Use Emitex, folks.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you very much.